supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A name familiar for decades in the world of Pennsylvania politics has a new battle on his hands, and this one is with a debilitating disease, as WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
I saw what it did to my mother. So I was stunned and a little bit scared when Dr. Stern told me I had early onset Parkinson's.
Former Pennsylvania Governor and Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell says watching his mother battle Parkinson's made getting his own diagnosis tougher. Rendell says he received that diagnosis 3.5 years ago. Jesse Rendell says it took a lot of pressure to have his father check out why his hands were shaking.
Just getting him to go to doctors and spend the time to really figure out what's going on with him and making sure that he's taking care of himself, I think, has been a challenge.
Leading Rendell's care is Dr. Matthew Stern, an expert in Parkinson's at Penn Medicine. He says treatment includes both medication and physical therapy.
Combine the use of available treatments, medications, with ancillary services, whether it be physical therapy, exercise with a personal trainer, all of it combines to reduce the disability associated with Parkinson's disease.
Therapist Heather Cianci says that includes boxing, especially trying to hit gloves held up by a partner.
The theory behind boxing with someone with Parkinson's disease is that it hits a lot of points on something we call neuroplasticity, which means we're driving brain change. We are working on challenging situations. We're working on challenging the balance as well as the gait.
Rendell says he's using seemingly simple mental tasks to stimulate his brain.
Name a car that begins with C. Name a car that begins with F. Name a car that begins with G. You know, you think you know that stuff, but when you're in the midst of doing it, it becomes pretty hard. But that's, I assume, to align your mental responses with...
Absolutely, yeah. Cognitive dual tasking, to just take it to the next level of a challenge, because we know that there is also cognitive slowness.
At this point, doctors say Rendell's medication and condition have been stable for a year. Rendell says he's proud he can do something most of us would take for granted.
In the house that I bought, I had an old refrigerator, a good refrigerator, but an old refrigerator. It still has ice trays. I can fill my 4 ice trays, stack them up, bring them from the sink to the freezer without spilling a drop.
Rendell says he has made his diagnosis public to encourage other people to see a doctor when they first see symptoms so they can receive the same type of treatment he has. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
In this budget season, New Jersey's new governor and the Senate president are at odds on how to raise more money for the state and how to divvy up funding for public schools. Chesterfield is a small town with lush horse farms in Burlington County, and it's been the most shortchanged by the state in the current proposed budget. As Karen Rouse reports for WHYY, that dubious distinction has galvanized parents and school officials who are now dogging the governor and legislators in Trenton to give public schools more money.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair.
At an assembly budget hearing in Trenton, Chesterfield parent Andrea Katz didn't waste time telling legislators what she thought of Democratic Governor Phil Murphy's education spending plan.
The preliminary aid numbers released by Governor Murphy's administration are an insult.
Katz is a leader of the Fair Funding Action Committee, which is made up of parents and officials from school districts in South Jersey. Chesterfield, by the state's calculations, is due $4 million for schools next year. Under Murphy's plan, it would get less than a quarter, $850,000.
I thought that after 8 years of Governor Christie, Governor Murphy would be a breath of fresh air. I was hoping that Governor Murphy would stand by his own words and provide...
On the campaign trail, Murphy was adamant. Kids in the state's nearly 600 school districts deserved the state's full financial support.
If we're not funding our kids' education in the state, what good is government? So we want to turn that on its head. We want to find the resources that we're going to need to find to fund fully public education in the state of New Jersey.
The state Supreme Court approved a funding formula a decade ago that takes into account 4 factors for each school district: the average income of residents, property values, the number of kids with special needs, and population shifts. During his campaign, Murphy promised to honor the formula, and that was what Chesterfield and hundreds of other similar districts longed to hear after 8 years of Republican Governor Chris Christie. He ignored the formula and essentially kept districts on a fixed income. Now in office, Murphy is finding out how difficult it is to make up years of underfunding. About two-thirds of all the districts in the state are getting less than what they're supposed to get under the formula because there's not enough money.
Our budget envisions a four-year ramping up to fully fund the formula.
But it's not just funding the formula that has people upset. There are a couple of other problems. First, there is what's known as the cap. The court mandated that districts can't increase their funding more than 20% per year. That means that Chesterfield, already millions of dollars behind, will have a hard time catching up. The other problem is that the percentage of the full formula that each district is due also varies. Hackensack gets 40% of the formula, while South Brunswick gets nearly 100%. That's largely because some districts lost students while others saw a spike in population over the last 10 years.
Something that I've been working on for
Senate President
years.
Stephen Sweeney, who has become a thorn in Murphy's side, unveiled a plan he says will level the playing field across districts.
Actually, the injustice where you have two classes of kids, the haves and the have-nots.
Sweeney's plan attempts to share the pain equally, instead of having some districts getting more, some getting less, and some getting 100%.
So we bring every district up to 56 or 58%. You know, when you hear about the Chesterfields at 20% and the Kingsways at 45%, every single school district will be at least funded at 58%.
Murphy has yet to comment on it, but Chesterfield Superintendent Scott Haino has been advocating for something similar. Before I visited Chesterfield, Haino warned me that Chesterfield is a pretty nice-looking school, and he was right. I've been to barren schools in dilapidated communities. Chesterfield is pristine. Lush farms and mini colonial homes with American flags planted on front porches. The school is 7 years old, new and bright.
You're right, it is a nice school.
From the outside looking in, you're going to think, you know, what do these kids need more than what they already have? There's no doubt about that.
This is a picture of her with her teacher, Ann Sullivan, and that water pump.
He takes me into the library, where the students are learning about Helen Keller. Their teacher shows them the book.
It's just a water pump.
Oh,
yes. Luckily, we don't have to use these anymore.
It's just water, but
you get your water from a faucet.
The library is bright, spacious, and welcoming. But Haino says it's one of the areas hurt by the lack of funding.
Even as you look over here, we have some bare shelves. But a library could have anywhere, you know, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 every year where you're trying to replenish books. Last year, we didn't do any.
And he says there are other areas. He needs a second guidance counselor, a special education teacher, and an assistant principal. Danielle Ferry is a researcher with the Education Law Center in Newark. They advocate for full school funding for public schools, particularly those with low income and at-risk students. She said Chesterfield may be getting the lowest percentage of their state share compared to other districts, but other school districts are worse off when the high-need students are factored in, like those in poverty, with disabilities, or have limited English-speaking ability. The extra money makes sure kids have teachers and support staff and other services. Ferry has calculated the per-pupil spending based on those needs. In Chesterfield, students are underfunded by $1,300.
In the scheme of things, that's not that bad.
Because in Patterson, it's $4,700, and in Bayonne, it's $6,200. Chesterfield's problem began a few years before the formula was approved by the Supreme Court. It was mostly a large farming town, but in 2006, construction began on a planned housing subdivision in one corner of town. Andrea Katz of the Fair Funding Action Committee said it helped prevent sprawl. But it also tripled the school population. It now has 780 kids.
It was great, but now we're dealing with this growth that came online very, very quickly, and it's causing this problem in the school district because we didn't anticipate the state not keeping up with their obligations.
And that means the school's funding problems have fallen on the town. New Jersey funds public schools from two main sources, property taxes and state aid. When the state falls short, taxpayers like Katz, who is also a town committee woman, carry the load.
My house is pretty average, and we pay between $12,000 and $13,000 a year in taxes. And the majority of it goes to the school.
That will likely continue unless legislators and Governor Murphy can reach an agreement in Trenton before the June 30th deadline. For WHYY, I'm Karen Rouse.
Local heritage blends into a local frozen treat in a unique collaboration this week. Joining me to whet our appetite for Philadelphia watershed ice is Diana Liu, Community Engagement Editor for Plan Philly. Diana, how did the project come together?
Well, this was many months in the making. We've been trying to figure out a way to really bring to life a lot of the stories and neighborhoods that Plan Philly talks about. So we coordinated with Little Babies Ice Cream. We have today Pete Adjavine from Little Babies, Justin DeBernardinas, who is a senior director of programs and partnerships over at Bartram's Garden, and Julie Slavitt, who is the executive director for the Tucani-Taconi-Frankford Watershed Partnership, or TTF.
So Pete, let's start with you. Where did Little Babies come in?
So we have a lot of experience telling stories and bringing people together through ice cream, and this seemed like a good fit.
So when we first started working on this, we were just wondering, how do you capture the essence of these different neighborhoods in Philadelphia? How can we do it through the lens of city planning, but also some very distinct networks that connect Philly's neighborhoods?
So naturally, we thought ice cream. But as we were talking about the watersheds, it became clear that water ice was the proper fit for this. And traditionally around this time of year, we make one batch of water ice for the whole summer. And so we decided to blow it out a little bit this year with this project.
So let me put this out to Julie and Justin. Plan Philly and Little Babies worked with your friends groups to develop the flavors that represent the immigration history and heritage of Taconi Creek Park and Southwest Philadelphia. Describe the communities.
Well, I'd say for Bartram's Garden, we're sitting in Southwest Philadelphia. That's a predominantly African-American neighborhood, though an incredible and growing African immigrant community. Philadelphia's Africa Town is growing and vibrant on Woodland Avenue. So I think when we're thinking about what are the flavors of Southwest, how do those flavors come out of our Sankofa Community Farm? That's a farm at Bartram's Garden devoted to Black and African-American heritage and food heritage. That this idea of creating a flavor rooted in those heritages, that's the direction we wanted to go.
And the communities that are neighbors to Taconi Creek Park are really diverse communities as well. You know, Philadelphia is a really diverse city. So a lot of Spanish-speaking folks, a lot of folks from different Asian communities. What brings us together with Bartram's Garden and this special project is that we're along the circuit trails. We're part of the Alliance for Watershed Education. And these circuit trails connect us and connect the whole region. You know, it's a 750-mile regional system of trails that's expanding all the time, and it's one way that we can connect. We can engage people who are running by or walking by or coming to one of our environmental education centers along those trails and talk to them about the Delaware River and how important that work is, and talk to them about being good stewards of water so that we can all have really delicious water ice.
And so how did you figure out what flavors to hone in on?
Well, we have a friends group. And we took a walk with them and talked to them about the different kind of flavors. And at a friends group meeting, we discussed this project and we threw it out there and got some really interesting suggestions from folks. One of those was buffalo chicken. We decided to stay away from that. So, you know, folks in our friends group represent those communities. And some folks talked about coconut and horchata being the top choices. And then they decided that they wanted to combine them. So what we ended up with is cocochata.
So for the uninitiated, what's horchata?
So horchata is a drink that is made with rice, and it's a popular drink that you can pick up in Philly's neighborhoods in your local bodega, and that was one of the flavors that we wanted. So the coconut, the rice, they went together to become cocochata.
And for us at Bartram's, a really important part of the Sankofa farm is that there's 30 kids, mostly from Bartram's High School, who have jobs working at this farm. So they're growing organic produce. They're growing a lot of the ingredients that we were drawing from.
Plan Philly went over to visit with the students at Sankofa a few weeks ago. And so we had a conversation with the students to really dive into what they did and what they grew. And from that, the conversation naturally then went to what the flavors were that represented their community and their neighborhoods. And you can listen here to the conversation that we had with the students.
Maybe what she said, maybe we should just have a mixture of all different types of food. Because I feel like in Southwest, it is very diverse. And I feel like maybe we could have like Asian pears and then have like some type of African fruit and have some type of, you know, fruit that, you know, we all know and love, and then all over the world, and it'll be one big flavor. And then, yeah, literally the diaspora.
you know, an important part of the Sankofa Farm and the mission of it there at Bartram's Garden is to reconnect urban communities back to the land and back to an agricultural heritage that frequently is only a few generations removed but can be lost. But a very important thing that we teach is this idea that for people who are in diaspora, people who have been moved across continents, we can lose our oral and our written histories, but our food really carries the history of where we're from, who we are, what our culture is. And that drove us to a beverage that you can find up and down, like I said, Philadelphia's Africa town down there, called Bisop. And this is a West African hibiscus tea that you can find throughout the full run of the African diaspora throughout the world. You'll find it in the Caribbean. You'll find it in South America. And it has many different names, many different flavors and versions. The Bisop that we find in Philadelphia has an Afro-Caribbean character to it. It's this hibiscus tea sweetened with sugar cane and with ginger. So that's something that you'll see in Jamaica. That's something you'll see in other parts of the Caribbean. And it's a flavor that you can definitely find very frequently in Southwest Philadelphia.
And so, listeners want to know, where's the Bisop Block Party?
Thursday, June 21st, 7 to 9 p.m. at Bartram's Garden. We're going to have a very exciting solstice event. You can boat out, get water ice from our floating water ice parlor that's going to be on the Schuylkill.
So is this a uniquely one-time summer solstice event?
We do free boating at Bartram's Garden to get on the river every single Saturday, April through October. We layer in some other things. We're also doing evening paddles during every full moon. This will be the only Bisop event.
For us, this won't be a one-time event. There'll be three block parties. They won't all feature this fabulous Coco Chato water ice, but they will have some water ice. The first block party that'll be our special block party, our Discover Your Park, Celebrate Your Creek block party, will be on Tuesday, June 19th, and that is at I Street and Ramona Avenue. That'll be the first one. And then there's one on Wednesday, and there's one on Thursday. And if you go to our website at ttfwatershed.org, you can see the locations of the other two.
Diana, Julie, Justin, Pete, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Who wants to be an astrophysicist? Now, before you submit an application, let's consider the job requirements with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, I suspect you hear from lots of kids considering a career in the field of astronomy, but if it's as focused as astrophysics, how do you stoke the enthusiasm and still convey the required rigor to pursue it?
I do get this question often from students, from high school students, or parents of high school students who have an interest in astronomy and astrophysics as a career path. And while it may look very exciting, the idea of being at the observatory at night with your eye at the eyepiece making fabulous discoveries, the reality is that that's not the way things actually go these days. It's much, much more rigorously tied to research, mathematics, computer modeling that require an interested party to really be deeply interested in those aspects of astronomical research rather than the more romantic idea.
Does that almost immediately disqualify most who otherwise think they want to go into the field?
Well, that's a really interesting question. What we have to do is we have to make sure we can give those folks who are interested in this a much better look at what the career is so that they can make the choice for themselves. So, tomorrow evening, June 19th at 7:30 p.m. at University of Pennsylvania's David Rittenhouse Laboratories, I'm doing a program in collaboration with University of Pennsylvania and the Simons Observatory. I'm moderating a panel discussion for aspiring astrophysicists about what it takes to become an astrophysicist and what the life of an astrophysicist is like. I have three astronomers who are in town for a meeting about their particular astronomical research project, along with a group of others who are going to help us answer this question. And so I'm reaching out as far as I can across the Delaware Valley to ask high school students and their parents, this is the program for you to bring your student to if that student is expressing an interest in astrophysics, because they'll have a chance to ask these astronomers questions right up front about what it's like to be in this career field.
Of course, astrophysics is a subset of the broader field of astronomy, and there are many career paths to consider.
So it could be instrumentation, or it could be telescope engineering, or it could be electronics, or computer software, or any of those, any of those associated fields that really could allow one to be just as close to this kind of work as possible.
There's another spaceship ride anniversary of note, and that took place in 1983.
Yes, that's true. Today, in 1983, Sally Ride became the first American woman to fly in space. And from that point on, women have been a significant portion of space crews going forward. Admittedly, it was a slow start to get more women into the program and up to speed as being regularly part of space shuttle crews. But today, the person that has the greatest number of hours on board International Space Station is a woman, Peggy Whitson.
That it took until 1983 to reach this milestone, was that due in part to a notion that perhaps women weren't up to the rigor of space travel?
Actually, it's the result of an American military reluctance to place women in space. So women had been through all of the same rigors, flight training, flight education, capability of flying jet aircraft, everything the men had gone through, but still weren't selected until 1983. In 1963, the Russian space agency selected Valentina Tereshkova to become the first woman in space, but that's 1963, just 2 years after their first manned flight into space. So you could say that the Soviet Union was well ahead of us in that particular aspect. And today, we see that there are fewer Russian women in the space program, yet Americans now have many, many more women involved in the space program, flying regularly.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.